Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I'm the editor of the TLS. Still apart after seven long weeks with little hope of face-to-face reconciliation, I'm remotely here with Thea Leonarduzzi.
Hello.
I'm so bored of food. Can you tell
and
me
yet
a nice...
every week you ask.
I know. I want to... tell me a nice meal you've had.
Well, can I tell you a story about a failed meal instead? I think you might enjoy it more. It has a happy final twist.
Okay.
So at the weekend, I had, do you know what colomba is? It's panettone, but for Easter. So it's in the shape of a dove.
Lovely.
I had loads of leftover colomba and I didn't know what to use it for. It was going stale. And so I thought, I'll make a bread and butter pudding. I've never made that before. I hear it's nice. I think I
make that all the time.
Once in my life.
Yeah, I make it with my daughter all the time.
Well, it turns out I don't like it.
Oh.
But so I'd used all the colomba and I'd made it. It's all right. I gave it to other people, you know, safely. But I had, for part of it, I'd taken some raisins and currants and I'd soaked them in brandy.
Nice.
And I sort of left some leftovers in the cup and then I washed it out this morning, but evidently not enough. So my coffee this morning came with a delicate whiff of brandy. So it was like a less hardcore caffè
corretto.
Which I appreciate puts me on a slightly slippery slope, but it was quite
I had
nice.
You, I,
it was quite
I,
a nice start to the day.
I had your dad as someone who secretly laces their coffee
little
with brandy. Anyway, yeah, yeah. I make it often with croissant.
Yeah, I've heard
bread
that's
and butter
nice.
Pudding. And it's
even
nice.
Even more butter.
But you've got to, I mean, the thing is, it's English stodge. I think you've either got to really want that sort of custardy English stodge or not.
Yeah, I think that was the problem. It was also the hottest day of the year, I think, on Saturday, so it wasn't very well thought through.
No, but next time do send it some to me, because I do like it. Right, listen to feedback, Thea.
Yes.
We've had some serious emails that we need to pay due respect to. Chris Stewart emails from Washington in America to urge caution in naming my cat Boudica, because he did the same thing, and he says this: about 20 years ago, we did exactly that, but having two small children, the name quickly morphed into Boody and then Booty. A dull name, but it stuck. Also, my son happened to get bit by the cat. Oddly, he's fine with cats now, but has an aversion to early British history.
And, can you imagine calling that out the window?
What, Boudica?
Booty.
Booty, yeah. Well, the thing is, we've not only got this cat, we've... now getting sent video because it's too young to come to us. It's only 4 weeks old, so it's going to come to us in a month's time. But the owner is going to send us a video every couple of days of little baby Boo, the kitten. Isn't that lovely? Little ginger cat. Now, literary pets continue. We have Joyce Carol Oates writing in the paper about her cat called Zansh. I'm presumably mispronouncing that. Zansh. Do you know where that comes from?
No, only because I've read it. Yeah.
It comes from The White Devil by John Webster. Victoria's Servant is called Zansh. I don't know. I've only ever read it. Anyway, Joyce Carol Oates writing about her cat in the paper. Joanna Gray apologises for no cheese connection. Apology accepted, but tells us that she's adopted a cat and called her Holly after breakfast at Tiffany's.
You're a lovely slinky black thing, I imagine.
Yeah, I hope so. Alan Perkins sends a picture of his Cavalier Beagle Cross dog. I'm not sure we're going to approve of this. Who my wife daftly allowed me to name Jean-Luc Dogard.
I like it.
Star Trek. Lucy Dallas would be fine about that, I think. A couple more. Andrew Morris emailed to say he won a Zoom quiz because he was asked the name of the Bronte brother and could answer Bramwell because of the name of a friend's cat. And apropos of nothing, he also tells us that because Russian doesn't have an equivalent of the letter H, Harry Potter is known as Gary Potter. Can that be true?
I don't know. It may well be true.
Yeah, I'm going to believe it anyway. It's too. I was going
to
check.
It's too good not to believe.
Yeah, it was too good to check in the journalistic phrase. So I'm believing him. And I got a very long, hugely enjoyable email from Bill in Illinois, with full of lockdown tips. One was dense reading, and the idea is, especially if you've got kids, don't go for froth, which you won't find respiting the time you have to spare. Go for 3 or 4 pages of something hard, and he recommends Montaigne's On Vanity or something by Borges. He also suggests The Divine Comedy. The plot is clear and easy to follow. He descends step by step and rises step by step. Read it as a science fiction novel, an exploration of another world. You must have read it as a kid, dear. Do you read Dante in Italy? You must do.
Oh yeah. Well, we sort of had to.
Is he sort of Shakespeare? You've just got to do it.
Yeah, exactly. There's no say in the matter.
And more importantly,
well, you know, parts of it at least, maybe not the whole thing.
yeah. And more importantly, Bill, every Saturday morning, Bill has Belgian Waffle Day.
What's that? Is
that too stodgy for you?
I don't really like sweet things in the morning.
Oh, for God's sake, Theo, where's your, apart from brand, apart from booze?
very boozy coffee.
Okay. Please do keep your comments coming. Literary pets, lockdown food, things for Thea to have in the morning that she might like.
The boozier the better.
Yeah, the boozier the better. And also send us the single book you'd recommend for someone going slowly bored at home, your kind of desert island book. What would you choose? At Stig Abel, at the TLS, at Thea_Leonarduzzi on Twitter, or email me stig.abel@the-tls.co.uk. And make sure you're subscribing to the TLS to keep all this going. All you need to do is use this special offer code, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. The best price anywhere on the internet, 6 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up on this week's show, my favourite philosopher and handily the philosophy editor of the TLS is Tim Crane. He's written a piece about artificial intelligence and will talk us through that and other things in the paper of a philosophical bent. And everyone has been talking about Defoe's The Journal of a Plague Year. Well, the wonderful author Will Eaves has written about it, and newsflash for you, TLS Books is going to be publishing a special ebook of Defoe's classic with Will writing an introduction. So get some early info on it now. One criticism of philosophy is that it tends to ask unanswerable questions, and even when there are answers, they don't actually affect the real world as we ordinary people will understand it. The mind-body problem may be a problem, but my life continues whether it is or it isn't. But can philosophy help us deal with the uncertainty of the world as we are experiencing it at the moment? In the paper this week, Nigel Warburton offers us some philosophical approaches to the coronavirus, from Thomas Hobbes to Susan Sontag. Tim Crane, our philosophy editor, will talk us through that and his own essay on artificial intelligence, plus pick out some other highlights, including how we smell and profiles of Jeeves's favourite philosopher Spinoza and the great populist Isaiah Berlin. He joins us from Budapest now. Tim, hello.
Hello, Stig. Hello, Thea.
Hello.
So I always have a bit of a jibe at philosophy, Tim, as you know. Is it always going to be condemned as being a sort of from the realm of the brain box, but not actually that relevant?
Yeah, thanks for that. nice, friendly sort of opening comment. The philosopher Jerry Fodor, he once said about Richard Dawkins that Dawkins is one of those scientists who disapproves of philosophy but can't resist doing a bit of it himself. Things aren't just irrelevant, full stop. You know, something's irrelevant to this or irrelevant to that. So irrelevant to what? Well, philosophy is a largely theoretical enterprise. It's an attempt at understanding. But that it does involve understanding how to live as well, and that's traditionally been part of the philosophical enterprise. But so that's my attempt to justify the relevance of philosophy. Philosophy is relevant to some things and not to others. It's relevant if you want to understand the world.
Right? Does that become particularly critical? I mean, one of the reasons we had this conversation, Tim, a while ago about getting Nigel Warburton to write this piece was, does it help you think about something as game-changing, as existential, to misuse the term, as coronavirus?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, clear thinking is relevant. I think you see a lot of woolly thinking around about this. You see a lot of panicking, a lot of exaggeration, and philosophy is supposed to keep things in perspective. I think that's part of its ambition. But what's really needed here, of course, is not the thing that you can supply without expert knowledge. What we need is, you know, how does this disease spread? How can we treat the disease? How can we stop it? How can we make sure it doesn't happen again? And, you know, philosophy doesn't have very much to add to that. And one thing that philosophers have tried to provide, some kinds of philosophers anyway, have tried to provide a sort of peace of mind, you know, or so we might hope.
And I suppose what Nigel Warburton's piece does so well is to show how people have thought, how people have kind of wrestled with whatever their particular reality was in the past. Yeah. And through reading that, then we can kind of try to grapple with our own. So he points to Susan Sontag, who's obviously quite a useful person to use to help us think about the now in terms of the way she drew our attention to language and the use of metaphor.
Exactly. So I think, you know, if you're going to try and achieve peace of mind, you have to think straight, you have to think clearly, to keep things in perspective. And these metaphors can get out of control. Nigel draws attention to all the war imagery that's been used in particularly in the British context. You know, we're talking about the Blitz spirit and the Prime Minister being a fighter and all these things. I think it's really important to realise this isn't like a war. This isn't what it is.
Yeah, and to realise that kind of language is, as he says, it's there's a danger to it. And I mean, I feel it's dangerous. It gives me shivers that I can't quite explain. So it's doing something. And he points specifically to Hungary, where you are, Tim.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, yeah, the Prime Minister here has used this opportunity to take on even more extreme powers than he had already. And he now rules in effect by decree. He's able to bypass Parliament and for an unlimited period. So, and this is like, you know, as Nigel points out, this is like treating the situation as if it was a time of national crisis, like a war, you know, where you think, you know, we now have to take on extreme and unusual powers to protect ourselves.
Which is something that Thomas Hobbes would approve of. So, and you know, if we go through this piece by Nigel and go through, consider some philosophers, but Thomas Hobbes's political philosophy would say that when things get hairy, you need strong leadership. And don't worry about the rights of individuals. You need something coming from the top that tells people how to behave.
That's right. I mean, I think that the interesting thing about Hobbes is that he thought that our natural state was a state of extremity. The natural state was a state where things were very hairy, to use your term, Stig, you know, appropriate for you. The natural state was, you know, the life of man is nasty, solitary, brutish and short, or whatever it was he said. You know, this image that we're all basically at war with one another individually, and the sovereign is needed to keep control. And this is why we give our power over. We give ourselves over to the sovereign so the sovereign can bring peace to us. I think most people don't actually think that these days. I don't think people think that, you know, if it weren't for absolute control of a monomaniacal ruler like Viktor Orban, for example, that society would fall apart. I think we're more optimistic about what society can do in non-extreme circumstances.
But you could make a case that in countries, I'm not sure this entirely holds up, but in countries which are more authoritarian, they are better positioned to dealing with something like a pandemic. The headlines this week in Britain about use good British common sense, which is kind of classic example of crass exceptionalism here. But the idea of that versus, say, Singapore, which has this ability to say you're going to stay in your home or we'll make you stay in your home, that type of attitude would suggest authoritarianism may be more successful in the short term in some areas.
It's true that, yeah, it's true looking at the cases that the authoritarian regimes have seemed to have done quite well, but also some non-authoritarian regimes have done well.
Yeah.
So, you know, Greece has done strikingly well.
And Switzerland.
Switzerland and South Korea. So we've got, it's important to get things in perspective, I think, you know, that you see, you think, oh yes, we need an authoritarian leader to stamp down on this. But then when we see that non-authoritarian countries are also doing okay, then we might be locating the problem in the wrong place.
Will you explain the, it gave us the headline actually for the piece, that this is quite a classical piece of philosophical wrangling, the trolley problem.
This is a famous thought experiment in moral philosophy, invented by the Oxford philosopher Philippa Foot. A trolley here refers to, it's the American term for a carriage going down a train towards a junction. And on one part of the track, there was one person who couldn't move. And on another part of the track, there were five people who couldn't move. And you were in a position where you could pull the lever to go either to the part where there was one person or to the part where there were five people. What should you do? So you're in a situation where you have to kill somebody. You will inevitably kill somebody. Should you choose to kill the five or choose to kill the one? Or should you save the five in order and sacrifice the one? And this is a puzzle that might seem, whose answer might seem obvious, but it isn't actually that obvious. And the way you tell the story gets very different responses. Is it legitimate to kill one person to save 1,000 people? Is it legitimate to, you know, for example, to have to execute one person to save five people? These discussions go on and on. But obviously the relevance today is that there are people making decisions about who to save in hospitals, making these absolutely horrific decisions about who should die and who they should try and save and who will survive. And so it's natural to look towards these more hypothetical, theoretical cases to see if there's some comparison. But I think, as Nigel points out, this is where the theoretical moral philosophy, which has its role, and the actual lived world of actually having to make a decision about who will die and who will live, really come apart. And to try and apply the moral philosophy case to the real world seems almost frivolous in these cases.
But does it, Tim? Because, you know, we're in the realm of utilitarianism sometimes. I talked to you, because I wrote a piece for the Sunday Times about John Stuart Mill, which is about, and there's the sort of the reverse of the happiness principle, which is the harm principle, try and do harm, a small amount of harm to a smaller number of people. And in the end, because there's no absolute cure at the moment to coronavirus, that's ultimately what everyone is doing. How much are you willing to sacrifice the lives of people who may die in the next year anyway, versus sacrifice an entire country's economy, which may harm people in much more people for longer in just as bad ways? I mean, these are all impossible calculations, but ultimately they are the calculation that people in governments across the world are making. It's not a theory, that is practice, and it has to be the practice, doesn't it?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Policy decisions have to be made which have consequences about who will live and who will die. That's certainly true. And in weighing up, you know, what the consequences, you take into account of how many people will die, you know, under what conditions they will die, and so on. My own view is that it's totally wrong to think of that as a sort of model for morality, as if this was somehow you were doing something that was good by letting these people die or choosing that certain people die. You have to make a practical decision, but that's a question of, so to speak, public policy rather than individual morality. Whereas the original trolley problem was about, you know, how do you do the right thing? Right? Well, you do the right thing by bringing about the greatest amount of good. What's the greatest amount of good? Well, the utilitarians say it's the greatest happiness of the greatest number. Well, that would imply certain things, that you actually do the right thing if you say, you know, kill a man to give enormous happiness to, you know, millions of people or something like that. The sort of examples people talk about. So I think we have to distinguish between policy questions and morality. And I think,
But policy questions, but the policy in the end will be judged, or should it be judged, on its morality?
Not necessarily. I don't think so. I think there are other considerations come into, like, you know, the there are economic considerations. We judge, I mean, so that you should judge, my view is you should judge politicians on the consequences of their actions. And the consequences of their actions are not all moral consequences. There are things like the good of the economy, the good of the nation, the security of the nation. And then there are moral principles like, you know, don't kill people unless you really have to, or something, you know. And all these things are going to be weighed up in a political situation. And I think using a simple moral calculation is not going to help. So I suppose I'm saying philosophy can, if you think about this philosophically, maybe it will make some difference to how you should think about the virus, as opposed to what I said a few minutes ago.
Yeah, that's my point. You're butterflies, aren't you, philosophers, in my experience. What about the other question? Because we are talking about big issues here of life and death. And there's a Montaigne is quoted by Nigel Warburton. I think Montaigne is quoting someone else, actually, when he says this, that we learn philosophy in order to learn how to die. Do you feel, Tim, as someone who's kind of immersed in philosophy, that when it comes to the question of your own mortality or those around you, that you will have gained a sense of perspective that you talk about because of philosophy? Is that realistically an aim? Or is that, you know, to me, it might be that that sounds good in theory, but isn't just there in practice?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to say in general. I'd like to think so. I'd like to think philosophy gives you a sense of proportion, a sense of perspective. You try and abstract from your own condition to see things in some intelligible, abstract way. So I'd like to think in some way it gives you some sort of, you come to terms with your mortality. But I'll get back to you on that. In 20 years' time, if we can carry on talking about this, or let's hope more than 20 years' time.
Yeah, bless you, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. But there's a question of the individual motivations why people study philosophy, and there are many, many of those.
There's that great line from Voltaire, isn't it, when he said by a priest on his, I bet this isn't true, but in case it is, he's asked by a priest on his deathbed, do you deny the devil in all his forms? And Voltaire allegedly said, this is no time to be making enemies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I think the relationship between philosophy and, you know, and our, the awareness of our own death is a very important thing, but it's not the whole story.
Tim, you flashed us forward, I think, 20 years, and then you generously gave us a little more time. Well, look, let's flash forward 100 years. Is it possible that we would be having this whole discussion with all of these little rivulets that we've made room for with a robot?
No. Good, next question.
Well, tell us why then. I mean, how significant is the difference between, I find this interesting in your piece, between reckoning and judgment?
Real artificial intelligence, what people actually produce, the sort of stuff that's in your phone, is absolutely amazing. And the things that the people have managed to do through what's called, you know, machine learning, or sometimes called, people call, deep learning, the way that machines can learn things now is extraordinary and couldn't have been predicted in the beginning of the days of artificial intelligence in the 1960s. But there's no evidence that artificial intelligence as it now is could produce something that was a genuine conversation. What computers do ultimately is that they compute, that is, they calculate, and information is represented in various forms in the computers, and the computers do certain things with it. They process information, and that's true of the newfangled AI machines, just as it is of the old pocket calculators. So computers compute, and that's what Cantwell Smith in the book I was reviewing calls reckoning. Computing is reckoning. Hobbes, actually, interestingly enough, he was the first person who connected these things. He said that reasoning is nothing but reckoning, in his typically sort of reductionist view. Reasoning is nothing and reckoning, just adding and subtracting ideas. That's what Hobbes said. But Cantwell Smith disagrees with that. And he says there's something else in human life or in real thinking, which is what he calls judgment, which is somewhat more hard to define. But something about having an awareness of the significance of things and how things matter to us. As the philosopher John Hoagland, who influenced Cantwell Smith, says, computers don't give a damn. That's the thing about computers. They don't give a damn. I mean, this is at the heart of Cantwell Smith's objection to the claims made on behalf of AI. And he's an AI scientist himself. He says that's the essence of it, is that computers don't have anything like judgment.
But is there an argument, Tim, that because what he says and what you say is that you can create an artificial environment like a chess game, and a computer can become brilliant at that and beat everybody, or a Go game, which is even more complicated than chess. Is there an argument that if you could create a complex enough equation that accounted for the complexity of the real world, in the sense that you could build equations around existence that deals with the level of complexity that we deal with every day, if that were possible, it would be possible for a computer to then manage itself within those rules, and that would be akin to becoming a judgmental creature.
We might, in some sense, be able to build, it's possible to build a copy of a human being that does everything a human being does. Is that possible in principle? Well, in the broad sense of possible, in the philosopher's sense of possible, I think it is possible, because the human being is a material object. And everything the human being does, including thinking, is a consequence of its material nature one way or the other. So if you reproduce that material nature, you'll reproduce everything a human being does, including thinking. It's a different claim to say that there are some equations or algorithms that describe everything that a human being does, and somehow you could implement those, you could write down those algorithms and implement them on a computer, and if it was complicated enough, then that would be a genuine artificial thinker, because it's highly debatable whether everything that a human being does is capturable in terms of algorithms and in terms of kind of things like outcomes. You know, so the crucial point about chess, and or even about Go, I mean, impressive as it is that they built this machine that could beat the world champion of Go, the crucial point about Go is that it's a game. And a game has an end, and it has a point, you know, the point where you can say the player has won when such and such a thing happens. Something like human conversation has no end, has no point, has no purpose. There's no thing. How do you get a machine to speak with you in a conversation? Well, then you'd have to know, if you're doing it in the standard AI way, you'd have to know what the end point of the conversation is, or what the purpose or the goal of the conversation is. And so we all know, you know, we've had that experience of talking to Siri on our iPhones or whatever the inferior Android version of it is.
It's Alexa in my house.
Alexa. Well, Alexa is quite good, but if you wanted to have a conversation with Alexa, I mean, you can't. You just can't.
And my kids try all the time, and they think it's funny to say, Alexa, do you smell, and stuff like that. And
it's great fun. And the answers obviously are canned responses. You know, that's what, because they anticipate what kids are going to ask. And in that respect, AI has not improved since the 1960s or 70s.
Sorry, and in fact, Alexa, do you smell is quite an interesting question. I mean, can crucially, would a robot be able to smell? Can we talk about the philosophy of smell? Because I found that piece really interesting.
Yeah, that's a very interesting piece. Yes. So smell. So philosophers have tended to talk about, when they talk about the senses and sense experience, going back to the very beginning, Plato had this view that the senses were sort of deceptive, they didn't tell us about reality. But they only gave us this kind of this image or simulacrum of the ultimate reality, and the ultimate reality must be known through reason. And then other philosophers have said that we actually can know the real world through the senses and so on. But the striking thing is that the sense that everyone focuses on here is vision, and that on the whole, and philosophers tend to emphasize vision as when they talk about sense perception, they normally just assume they're talking about visual perception. Whereas, of course, and this book by Anne-Sophie Barwich is really interesting. I haven't read the book, but it sounds very, very interesting. Emphasizes that there's all sorts of different things about smell. Smell is an incredibly important sense to us. I mean, not least because most of taste is smell, in fact, anyone would find out if they did that. Have you ever done that wonderful experiment of biting into an apple and an onion? blindfolded with your nose completely blocked.
Oh, no. And what happens?
You can't tell the difference. You can't tell the difference. It's from what's going into your on the receptors on your tongue, cannot distinguish between an apple and an onion.
And in this whole area, Tim, as it was with the AI, I always glibly mention the mind-body problem, which is the sense that, you know, there is this materiality, but we don't really understand what connects the material nerves firing here, there and everywhere to how we actually feel about things. And that's the problem, that you can't necessarily recreate that for robots. And even in the sense of smell, we can look at, there's an epithelium, I think is talked about in this piece, which is a receptor and takes the information. We still don't fully understand how that all means a smell and how we then respond to that smell, do we? That's the great mystery at the heart of all of life and all of philosophy.
That's right. I think it's the mystery of the art of all of philosophy. Some will disagree with it. I agree. Yeah. So how do you get from, you understand the mechanisms of these things. And I think one of the interesting things about Bawich's book is that she's trying to explain how those mechanisms do give us an understanding of the phenomenology, that is to say, of how things seem to us. But ultimately, there's this question, why does anything seem like anything at all? Why is it that by putting together these cells in this way, we get the wonderful conscious experience of tasting something delicious or smelling something delicious or smelling something disgusting? And that is the great puzzle, that is the mind-body problem. You know, it's like the artificial intelligence question in this way. I mean, it is a philosophical question because people don't really know what it is that they're asking when they ask it. And that's why we're going around. It seems like we're going around the houses all the time. With artificial intelligence, you might think, yeah, but surely if you had a computer that just did the way we just made the computer much more complex and it could just do all the things that we do, but just in a more complex way, then it would think. See? But we don't know what complexity means here. We don't know what it is for a conversation to be more complex than the one you have with Alexa or with Siri. Similarly, in the case of the smell, I mean, I think what we're talking about here is, you know, we've got to focus on the right questions. What are we trying to understand when we say we can't understand how the brain and the sense organs can produce experience?
And this is my point, Tim, because I'm fascinated by it. I love talking to you about it. But the point is that if I go out of this room now and smell a rose, then in the common sense world of reality, I will lean down, smell the rose. The rose will smell whatever it smells to me, and life will continue. So at one level, this is dramatically important. And at another, it's dramatically inconsequential. And I find that balance of the two with philosophy, it's interesting.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Hume said the same thing. David Hume, he said that when he goes out and plays backgammon or billiards or whatever it was he played, and he eats and drinks with his friends, his abstract speculations seem so cold and lifeless. Yeah. But there's a difference between living life and thinking about it, I suppose, sort of to put it in a very banal way.
Tim, should we leave it there? That's a good note to leave it on, I think, for anyone. Tim, what a great pleasure to speak to you.
You too, Stig. Thanks. And Thea, bye.
Bye, bye, bye. In other news, Stig, to bring us back to the observable world, can you picture the image that we have of Isaiah Berlin on page 11 of the paper?
Yeah.
What on earth does he have under his arm?
I don't know.
Can you picture it? I'd really like to launch a competition to name the object under Isaiah Berlin's arm, because to me, it looks like an absolutely enormous cigarette, but enormous.
I can't think. Okay. I'm going to get a copy of the paper. Anyone listening to this podcast should
find
get a
that
copy.
Quite easy.
Yeah, I should be able to do that. And all right, challenge accepted, Thea.
Name the object under Isaiah Berlin's arm.
Lovely.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Regular readers of the TLS will know that we have a newish recurring feature called, straightforwardly enough, rereading, in which a writer returns to a book that meant something or did something to them once and considers how things might have evolved over time, or finds an alternative prism through which to view a text, drawing out some new rich resonance. Rereading might then occasion a "but now I see" kind of reaction. A few months ago, in more playful times, Benjamin Markowitz revisited the fantastical advanced Dungeons & Dragons Player's Handbook. Remember that?
Yeah, it's great stuff.
This week, however, Will Eaves, a former arts editor at the TLS and the author most recently of the novel Murmur, has, for reasons all too painfully clear, stuck closer to reality and taken up Daniel Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year. Like a comet, he says, its time has come again. It brims with recognisable situations. Will Eaves is here now. Well, no, he's not. He's not here. He's there at home, but is alert, whatever that means. Will, hello, hello.
Hello. I'm ominously alert. I'm ominously close to you in the sound picture.
Yeah. You really are, and I'm glad of it. Right, well, look, I'm kind of hanging myself out to dry here a little bit, but I've never read the journal. So can you introduce us briefly, as if for dummies? And I'll emphasise the "as if" part of that. Thank you very much.
It's a marvellous piece of fake reportage. It is Defoe was a great journalist, and this is his account, written in 1722 and pretty quickly, of the 1665 Great Plague. You know, the last major visitation in this country. But it's also written in the light of an outbreak of plague in Marseille. A couple of years before he sits down to write. So it's sort of a strange, it's a very European phenomenon, the book. It's about not just the plague of London in 1665, which killed 100,000 people, but it's about the whole European experience of the plague over the past 300 years. And, you know, funnily enough, I just feel it's relevant on and evocative at so many levels now for us, because our situation is both intimately British. You know, we have a real catastrophe on our hands, many thousands of people dying, and of course it is also European.
And your new way of thinking about it is to imagine how it might translate to the screen. I mean, what would be some of the challenges?
Well, of course, I'm an extremely experienced screenwriter.
Well, so you are. I mean, sure. Well,
I think the thing is, it's the difficulty would, from the point of view of, you know, producers and people putting up the money for this kind of thing, if you did a film of the plague, on the one hand, people would say, well, this would be boffo box office because it's a disaster movie and they often do very well. The difficulty with any sort of disaster narrative is, and I think also the virtue, is that the disaster really takes center stage. And therefore, it's sort of quite difficult to know how you turn the narrative into a heroic narrative, how you put actors and actresses and sort of stars in that context. I think that's always a problem for that sort of film. But I think rather than see it as a problem, you have to see it as a virtue, because that really is the situation that Defoe describes. Although there's a narrator who's called HF, and we have to assume that the F stands for Foe, the family name, the narrator is not a hero, as Anthony Burgess once said. He is a narrator. So we are free then not to worry so much about his motivations, his arc, any of the things that, you know, the usual sort of producers and story showrunners go on about. We're free instead to think about the thing itself, the journalistic terrifying entity, which is the progression of the disease and the progression of the story at that level.
Which is one of the things that strikes me when we read Defoe and think about it is actually maybe that's the reason why there's probably relatively little literature of plague. When you think about it, you know, if you think about Chaucer hardly talks about plague, Shakespeare hardly talks about plague despite being completely immersed in it. 1918, the Spanish flu pandemic doesn't produce a great swathe of plague literature. You get modernism and you get the sort of shadow of it, but you don't really get a lot of dealing with it.
You get people talking about it, don't you? You get people saying the world broke in two, you know, but you don't actually get your truth. You don't then get heroically driven narratives. Yes, I think that's a good point. I think, though, that there are kinds of narrative that tend to be... it's a question of what you think of as being the normative sort of structure for a novel or a film. I suppose that's my point. We tend to think automatically that something has to have a lead or a three-act sort of recuperative shape where, you know, you come back to the beginning and things get better. And actually Defoe does give you that. There is a sense that the visitation ends and all is well again, which is the most sort of fictional element of the novel, really, because in fact the plague rumbled on well into 1666. And 2,000 or 3,000 more people died after the supposed end of the visitation, at least the end that we're given in this story. But I don't see why you can't have a film that's rather more free-flowing, that does follow the drift of the event itself without losing one's attention. Because I think actually people will wait and will select their characters from a sort of mosaic or a large cast, and they will follow things rather more individually and rather more sort of piecemeal, in a rather more piecemeal fashion than we are apt to think.
Well, you call it a caravan of episodes made up of people going through the same horror in different ways, and you can imagine a kind of almost like Mike Lee might do something like that, where he'd just have a...
Or like a book of short stories, actually. You know, it's a kind of something that's thematically unified, but isn't necessarily one person's story.
Sort of crucial to that, just to continue this idea of adapting it into a film, which we may do at the end of this, who knows. You sort of have to also cast unknown actors, because as soon as you have actors who you know, they sort of bring with them their previous body of work, and so you'll end up reading a hero into a given situation.
I think that's true. Who can remember, really? The people you tend to remember from disaster movies are the sort of supporting cast. Gene Hackman in The Poseidon Adventure is one that springs to mind. And equally, where novelists have tried to, you know, write about these kinds of sort of world-altering disasters, it's quite difficult to remember who the protagonists are. You tend to remember the situation. There's the Mary Shelley's The Last Man has a similar problem.
Is it an easy read then, Will? Because I think it's one of those books that everyone will have, or lots of people have heard of really in the last 8 weeks. Possibly, because they'll have heard of Defoe, they'll have heard of the novel for which he's most famous, and then they would have been like, well, Plague wasn't
the heat. I'm not sure.
Do you think they're thinking, oh, I've got enough of that at home at the moment?
I thought you were auditioning for a part.
I am. This is the terrible thing. Once you start writing these, you think, oh, I could do that.
I could, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But is it, is, is it an easy read? Is it a pleasure to read, Will? Because
well, interesting. When I first read it, which was back when I was a student, I remember it being the most. I found it the most difficult to read of the big novels, which would be of the four big novels, which is Robinson Crusoe, More Flanders, Roxana, and Journal of the Plague Year, and I found it the most difficult. Partly because it didn't seem to have a sort of a central character axis, but also because at the time I don't think I was really, how can I say it? I mean, I simply hadn't sort of lived enough to appreciate the tone of the book. And the tone of the book is the thing that's gripping, because the tone of the book is that of a person trying to get down all the journalistic material, the mortality bills, and the way, different ways in which people try to escape the visitation, different ways in which they die. And it's, the tone is that of someone gradually collapsing under the panic of their own description. the closer they get to what's happening, the more sort of frantic the writing becomes. And it's the balance that Defoe strikes between that sort of personal anxiety and fear on reflection and the sort of cool, calm, self-possessed way in which he actually makes things visible to the reader. It's that balance that's really interesting. And I think that is gripping, but maybe it's gripping for, maybe it's gripping for a sort of 40, 50 year old in a way that it's maybe not for a 16 year old. I don't know.
Or maybe it's gripping when the idea of a pandemic moves from a sort of theory to a reality. Cause I've been thinking about this, that say you're writing a realistic novel of the 2020 and you start writing it and then coronavirus happens. What do you do? Because you think, well, I'm going to have to reference it because it's become the whole world and therefore I can't pretend it doesn't happen. But then you don't want to write a sort of boring novel of lockdowns.
I'm beginning to think about writing another novel. I mean, I write at an absolutely tectonic pace when it comes to fiction. So, I mean, you know, just don't hold your breath. Or anything else. But I think that you don't have to try too hard to get extraordinary circumstances into one's prose. And in fact, I think it's probably a bad idea to try at all. I think that one's actual context seeps into the writing anyway. That's my conviction, really.
But I wonder whether we're going to get a lot of novels set very overtly in 2019, where you sort of say it was the summer of 2019, and then you might get in, say, Shakespeare, where clearly the experience of living in a plaguey city must inform all sorts of things. It might sort of seep into the stories and seep into the prose and the metaphors, and like you say, that context will become pressing.
What does tend to happen, I think, in imaginative writers dealing with real circumstances, it's the nitty-gritty, it's the kind of infrastructural stuff that's finds its way in, rather than those changes, rather than the big theme. I think there's often, you know, the idea that writers of fiction or dramatists are constantly thinking about, you know, what a great change in circumstances means, is often mistaken. They're just thinking about how something has changed, what has actually happened to the fabric of life. In the same way that, you know, when you read the sonnets, it's really interesting to think about how, you know, people get from A to B, i.e. the state of the roads. it's much more about the state of the roads, really, between London and Stratford-upon-Avon than it is about, you know, the imponderables of a particular relationship.
But the problem with that, Will, is that I'm just dreading, and this may be me being sort of 7 weeks into lockdown and just generally filled with despair, but I'm kind of dreading a great British novelist. Ian McEwan springs ineluctably to mind, doing his lockdown novel where three families across the country, each experiencing lockdown differently, learn something about the human condition, which is filled with detailed research, and a sort of state of the nation novel.
It may well happen. I mean, I think the thing is, you sort of have a choice, don't you? You either well, it's not a binary thing, but you know, I think there are obviously people who like to write very close to the grain of events and to do it, as Tim might have said earlier, very consciously. But I think that actually there's a sort of unconscious mechanism in most really satisfying imaginative writing, which is that, you know, you do what you were going to do anyway, but you find that it's become sort of party coloured by the sort of group experience. I think that's the way it works. I mean, I haven't got any proof to hand because I'm only about 4 pages in, but you know.
What do you want from me? You know, I'm trying my best.
Defoe gets through it, doesn't it, by kind of this postmodern approach where he's both a journalist. And this is true of Robinson Crusoe, which was also, he pretended wasn't, Robinson Crusoe was not set up as a novel, was it? It was set up as a journal and an account of something that actually happened.
The beginning of the very, very long tradition that goes right up to adventure novels and beyond of extraordinary fact. Yeah. You know, amazing adventures that are actually true.
Yeah.
and normally they have a sort of, what they develop after Defoe is they develop a frame, you know, so that people begin to sort of discover diaries, or you know, or they go to a lecture and they hear someone talk about the plateau in Africa, whatever it might be. But this is kind of earlier on in that, and it's different to Robinson Crusoe, which is, you know, which is a sort of discovered thing, because this doesn't bother with any frame at all. It's just an account of the plague as if it's a real documentary event itself.
Yeah.
I think that's what's interesting about the Defoe book. It's not as a, even though it's written 60 years afterwards, it doesn't feel as if it is. It feels as if it's written at the time.
And we hope people want to read it now, not least because we're going to publish an ebook of it, Will. We're going to, the TLS books are going to publish a text. You're going to supply the introduction. And we hope this is going to give some solace. I mean, I'm interested in the psychology of that. We may have to leave it here, but I'm interested in the psychology of people reading about pandemics in a pandemic, because clearly it does happen. You know, the plague by Camus has gone up the charts, and I think the same's happened to Defoe and to a couple of other books. People either will, I suspect, will either not want anything to do with historical plagues, or will want to completely immerse themselves in it. And I can't quite work out the psychology around either of those things.
Well, they're probably actually, they want a bit of both. I think the thing is, there is something, the question is, do you want to meet the reality of it in a rather sobering fashion, or do you want some form of reassurance, you know, some cathartic experience of it that, you know, that will make you sort of feel better at the end of reading the novel, whatever it is. And I think that's you know, the truth about that is that you get both with Defoe. There is the satisfaction of encountering a piece of imaginative art that has a sort of, you know, some kind of privileged status, but you also do feel you're getting something bracingly true. And that's an unusual to get that, I think, in the novel.
And we had Andrew Owen, who works for us, did a TV review. He talked about how he found consolation in Newsnight. Only in the sense that, which I find
you know, you've met him, you can imagine it, Will.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah, consolation in Newsnight.
Yeah, and the argument was this, Will, which I see if you buy, because I buy it as an argument. It's a very clever argument. I don't agree with it at all, but I think it's a very clever argument, which is journalism is sort of first draft of history, and therefore you are reminded that at one point this will be history. And that seems to me true of the Defoe, in the sense that the plague that he talks about was far more serious than the plague that we're talking about in terms of its lethality and its sort of vast impact, and the Black Death before it as well. But that too came to an end, and life continued and you know, life got better and developed, and that sort of Whiggish view that history always improves.
I think there's got a lot to be, you know, that's an interesting thing, a lot to be said for it. I think in a way, if there is consolation to be had in something like, you know, Newsnight or turning on and hearing Radio 4, you know, during a nuclear attack, I think what it is the idea that there is a sort of mechanism of understanding out there still that makes you feel other people are on the case too, and that you're not just adrift in a sort of terrible, you know, flood of agentless chaos.
Mm. That a process has been kind of activated and will be worked through, and we may emerge with lessons.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Well, should we leave it there and you can go off and write your novel, which may or may not include a...
get to page five.
Yeah, page five, and then the plague came.
I think I'm making a pretty solid start on page six.
Yeah. thank you so much for joining us today.
Delighted.
Thanks very much.
Bye, Will.
Bye.
It was made into a film, you know, Stig.
Was it?
It was in the 70s, apparently, with a screenplay by...
Of course, in the
70s, late 70s. There was a screenplay by Gabriel García Márquez, of course.
No.
It's called El Año de la Peste. Yeah, I looked it up and then I found on Wikipedia a little description of it. And there was just this short summary. A dreadful sickness is found in a Mexican town. A doctor tries to alert the authorities when he discovers its epidemic nature. No one listens to him and soon the illness spreads. The government tries to manage the information in order to prevent terror. Sounds quite familiar, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, thank God that wouldn't happen now. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Tim Crane and Will Eaves. Make sure you're subscribing to the paper. This week, after all that philosophy, we also have Stephanie Cy Queer on the books her ailing grandmother chose to read at the end of her life. It's a lovely, lovely piece that. We also consider what Bob Dylan's latest song really means. Next week, we stay in America for a US literary special. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.